Welcome to today's Job Seeker broadcast. Our topic is how to succeed at cold calling. And you know, if you're planning on getting a good job in 3 months or less, then you will need to be proactively contacting employers to ask about those hidden job opportunities. This is a most important topic. To help me discuss this, I am joined by a special guest co-host, Peter DePauli, who's had years and years of experience. Peter's out of Sherwood, Oregon, and he is one of our 12 preferred counselors featured on our website. You can see Peter's picture and bio. Just click Preferred Counselors on our toolbar. Hello there, Peter.
Good afternoon, John. It's good to be with you.
Yes, and good to be with you. We really have quite a topic here today, and I'm looking forward to our interaction on this. Peter's been counseling individuals in career advancement and job search since 1980, and that's over 33 years. He lives in Sherwood, Oregon, and has acquired two master's degrees, the most recent a master's in counseling. In addition to coaching individuals with their career, their resume, and job hunt, he has been an outplacement and assessment consultant to large and small business firms, government agencies, and nonprofit organizations. Peter is also an instructor for many local colleges and universities teaching career advancement and counseling. Now, as we turn to our topic, how to succeed at cold calling, I'm wondering, are you feeling down because of no employer responses? Have you recently thought you had the job and then were turned down? Or maybe your resume is just not getting the results you wanted? Well, if any of these feelings are nagging at you, I'm glad you tuned in, and I hope that our show will help you get that very best position. Please accept our invitation to join us by emailing your job seeker questions to jobseeker@idakgroup.com. For the first 15 minutes of our show, Peter and I will talk about our topic, how to succeed at cold calling, and then we'll take a short break and begin answering your job seeker questions, which we receive during our show. So, Peter, let us launch ahead with this topic, how to succeed at job hunting. And, you know, when you bring up something like this, we're reminded of the number one largest anxiety-producing activity that all of us were concerned about going through school, and that is having to get up and give a speech. I think cold calling probably is close to that. Would you agree?
Oh, yes, I'd agree. Actually, we were talking last night in class about this, and that is the number one fear that people have. And so when you either cold call or you're interviewing, what are you actually doing? You're actually speaking in public to strangers.
There you go. Well, this term cold calling also can be described as networking, beating the pavement, or knocking on doors. Those are terms that are normally associated with job hunting, all terms being those that people generally don't like to do. It is the proactive approach to looking for jobs as opposed to answering help wanted ads, answering vacancy postings. The fact of the matter is that 80% of positions are filled before they ever are posted. So if you're planning on getting a job in 3 months or less, you've got to tackle those 80% of jobs that are never posted. Now, for the purposes of our discussion, Peter and I are going to outline for you exactly how does somebody go out there and find these positions. How do they do the cold calling? However, in our preparation for the show, we discovered that the knowledge, the technique of how to cold call is not the problem. There's another problem that hinders stops people cold. They hit a brick wall, and we want to talk about that. There'll be a follow-up program to this entitled Cold Calling 102 that'll actually get into technique. But let me give a quick summary of the technique. Peter, fill in for me as I go through this. In order to proactively job hunt, the bottom line is that you do your research, find the names of individuals that would oversee the position that you want, you contact them, establish a relationship, and then inquire about the potential of a future position. And organizations that have future positions are those that are growing and changing. So that is the quest, to find those employers, to contact them, get a meaningful conversation going, get rapport, and then begin to inquire about future opportunities. Now, Peter, what have I left out in the definition part there?
Well, John, I think you're right. I think you have to look and see what kinds of things you're going to do the researching. But I think one of the things that you had mentioned when we talked was making sure you have a clear target. And a lot of times people just, you know, do the kind of the scattershot approach, and they don't have that clear target to aim at.
Absolutely, yes. And that's probably a huge detriment in succeeding at job hunting in the cold calling sense. You don't have a clear target. And unfortunately, what happens is people will say, well, I'm wanting to be a purchasing agent, or I want to be an IT director. Who do you know out there that's an IT director? Well, the problem with that is you've cut your referral network by 75%. People don't remember IT directors, but they do remember who's working for AT&T, Nike, Coca-Cola, Johnson & Johnson. And those are companies that you've identified by name that have that position you want. So what you want is someone who knows someone that works for that large company, and once you get that name, then that person will lead you to the employer, the manager, the department head that oversees your position. Now, before I go any further, we're kind of getting into the actual technique of the cold calling process. But, Peter, you and I realized that most of our clients, even after they have been trained and encouraged and in some cases given a nice swift kick to get out there, they just don't do it. And why is that? Why is it that they refuse to find 80% of positions that nobody else knows about? What's the holdup?
Well, John, I think it's a very common thing, and it's called fear. I mean, it's just the fear of the great unknown. It's the fear of, I've never heard it being done that way. I just thought you have to apply for positions that are open. What do you mean? Somebody could actually negotiate a private job vacancy, you know, vacancy that somebody would have there in an organization around maybe the need for somebody like me to be in that organization. So it's just amazing what fear does to people.
So I think, Peter, you and I agree on that. And so what we're going to do to help our listeners succeed in cold calling is we're going to hit this thing square in the middle. We're going to deal with overcoming fear. If a job hunter can overcome the fear of cold calling, they're going to get hired in 3 months or less. There's no question about it, because everyone else is afraid. You have no competition. So let's build a quick analogy here. Here's a kid, and he's looking around the neighborhood, and there are these other boys and girls a little older riding bicycles. Mm-hmm. And this kid's never ridden a bicycle. So this kid is thinking, hey, I would like to ride a bicycle, but I might get hurt, so I'm afraid. Why does that kid eventually end up riding a bicycle, Peter?
Well, because he wants to fit in with the rest of the group, and he wants to, you know, get up there and be part of the neighborhood.
Yes, and also this kid is seeing other people successful. He's going, well, if they can do it, well, I can do it. And he's getting a lot of encouragement, a lot of support. And, yes, the kid's going to fall down, but he'll get up again, and he'll do it.
Right.
And so as we consider this, there has to overcome the fear of cold calling. There has to be an acknowledgement, I can do this. I can get over this temporary state of white knuckles and perspiration and just a sense of total abject shock. I can get over this, and it takes an act of the will. Now, Peter, you and I have recently gone through the process of purchasing a new home. And it's interesting, both of us had the same experience in terms of finding that perfect home. Why don't you tell your story first, and then I'll tell mine.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with if you're proactive about it. A lot of people sit back and wait for their agent to do all the work for them instead of listing out the things that you're looking for specifically in a home and then looking at the criteria that's out there and you being proactive and going and looking for them instead of just sitting back and waiting for somebody else to do the work for you.
So you hopped in the car with your wife and went out looking, right?
That's right. That's right. We looked at over 100 homes.
And what happened?
We found the perfect home.
You found it, not the realtor.
Right. We found it. He basically did the paperwork, but we found the home, and it was all the criteria that we had set out that we were looking for.
That's exactly the same that happened to my wife and I. We had a good realtor. Realtors out there looking for us. But we also hopped in the car and looked around, and we were the ones that found the home. Our realtor helped us with the paperwork, but we were the ones. Now, just think, if you and I had not taken the initiative proactively to go hunting on our own, we would be stuck with second best.
I believe that because, John, we had talked about that. We said, you know what, if we had waited, or maybe somebody could have said, hey, this is a really good deal, you're going to miss it if you don't get it, we would have had, like you said, the second best instead of the one that we really know that we're supposed to be in.
The interesting thing that happened to me, I don't know if this happened to you, but as we got involved and we were proactively out there looking, we began to find homes that were just in the process of becoming listed. Mm-hmm. And yet we're not known. And we found one almost perfect home just exactly that way. We talked to the sellers. They hadn't yet posted it for sale. There was no sign on the lawn. And we almost, there just were a couple of things that just didn't quite fit. But it was incredible. We were astounded that here it was. We found this on our own, and it still was not yet listed. Now, let's take a couple of examples here, one in particular that's common to all of us to, again, illustrate this proactive approach. Let's say that you're doing a project at home, and you have to go to the hardware store.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to the hardware store, and you start looking around up. Time for break. We'll pick it up after the break, Peter.
Okay, John, we have a short 2-minute break. Today we've been talking about job search tips, but you do a lot more for men and women who are struggling with mid-career issues.
That's right, Evan. We do. We help men and women find that career sweet spot which can give meaning and purpose to their life.
So, John, what about boomers, those who are approaching retirement age? There are a lot of us out there.
That's right, Evan, many millions. We provide very specific help to boomers and their families.
You mean that the choice what to do after retirement is just as important as selecting one's career at 20 years of age?
Well, Evan, think on this. Let's say you've been grinding it out, just waiting for that 25-year goal pin, and now that's where you are. Does that mean your life of significance and purpose ends? You've heard that the new 65 is the old 45. A person still has 10, 15, maybe 20 more productive years ahead of them.
Well, I never thought of it that way.
Well, we help adults, many adults, find that ideal post-retirement career. For once, they don't have to be trapped into their occupation. They can be free to choose to give it back to make a difference.
But John, why couldn't a mid-30s person choose to do that?
Well, they most certainly can, and I hope they will. But some of us have been so close to the grindstone of work that we have never considered looking into the future of making a difference or giving back.
Okay, John. I want to discuss this further, that is, considering a purpose for what we do beyond a paycheck and benefits. Can we talk some more about this during the next break?
Sure, you bet.
If you just tuned in, our Job Seeker Weekly broadcast is sponsored by the IDEC Group, hosted by job search and career advancement expert John Bradley. John has been coaching men and women since the mid-70s to find fulfilling work. I'm Evan Newman. You can join our discussion today by emailing us your job search questions. Those questions received during the live broadcast will be given John's priority for discussion. Our address for questions is jobseeker@idacgroup.com. That's jobseeker@idacgroup.com. John, let's return to our broadcast.
And we're back to our topic, how to succeed at cold calling. And just before the break, Peter and I were launching Eloquent into an example. And my co-host today, Peter DePauli, is a counselor in Sherwood, Oregon. Many, over 30 years of career guidance, job search, and resume preparation experience. So, Peter, I was giving this example of going to a hardware store, you got a project going, and you get to that place where, oh, I just need this one part. And so let's call that part a bolt,
okay.
A 2-inch long bolt with a half-inch thread, and you need stainless steel. So off you go to the hardware store, and you go in, and you're scratching your head, well, where is that? So you ask one of the attendants, and they said, well, all the bolts are over there. You walk down to the aisle. You start looking around. You can't find it. You find another attendant, and the attendant says, sorry, we don't carry those. There you are. You're stuck. Now, the proactive approach to finding the hidden job isn't going to stop there. You have three options. First option is you ask, is there someone else that could help me at the store to find this? Second option, you ask, can you recommend another store where I can find this? And third option is, could you order one of these for me? Now, these three take you out of the comfort zone, but they assist you in getting the goal, helping you find what it is that you're looking for instead of just throwing your hands up and saying, well, I don't know what to do. I can't seem to find it. Maybe I better go find another project to do. Peter, any comments there?
Well, I think that's a good analogy because a lot of us, we just say, well, you know, we have an excuse not to do the project, or, you know, we'll go murmur and grumble that, you know, can't do this and, you know, I'm going to go eat worms kind of thing. And you never get around to doing the actual event. I don't know if this kind of ties in here, but we were talking about what does it take to kind of press on. And I had shared a little statement, 99% of failure is based upon people making excuses. That's George Washington Carver said that. And it's like, John, the excuse could be very much like, well, I don't have the bolts, so I'm not going to do the things, but then you fail to do the project. So isn't that interesting? 99% of failure is based upon people making excuses instead
yes.
of pressing through.
Exactly. Now, this is a $100,000 issue.
Yes.
You are getting the highest financial opportunity of your life, and it requires of you 100% commitment and devotion, not something on the fly. Once you're hired, you're going to be spending the majority of your waking hours doing this job. Why not get the best job you can? In order to do that, you have to overcome cold calling. Now, we've documented that even with professional coaching, individuals still refuse to do this. And the question then is, why? And the issue is fear, not the technique. It's not that the technique is the problem. It's the fear of talking to a stranger.
Right.
So let's launch ahead then on three steps to overcome fear. And Peter, you came up with just an incredible, important statement as the first step of getting over this, getting moving on, succeeding at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, first thing is decide that you will not stay unemployed. And we talked about the whole thing about dignity. I've said that to clients all the time. I said, you need to get some dignity and not stay mired in the pit. And a lot of times people get stuck in there, and they have no dignity. They'll say, well, I'll just settle for this, instead of pressing on and getting the best job.
Yeah. And unfortunately, after 3 months of unemployment, we start getting some a new factor is starting to evolve here, and that's discouragement and depression. We start making excuses. Oh, well, they're not going to see me. I'll never get through. Well, then we never pick up the phone. We never take the initiative.
Right.
So
right.
Step one, absolutely essential. You have to decide, I am not going to become a victim. I am going to get employed. I am going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I am not going to stay unemployed, and I'm going to get employed in 3 months or less. So that's step one. That is huge. You've made a commitment. Okay, step two. You need to know how to carry on a conversation with a total stranger. Most of us don't know how to do this, and when we try, we're all thumbs. We got our foot in our mouth, and it sounds awkward, and we don't like it, so we don't do it. But you must master how to start a conversation and keep it going. So our second step is we want you to practice at least once a day starting a conversation with a stranger. Now, here are all the opportunities that you have that just come naturally. You see strangers in the grocery line when you're buying your groceries. You see strangers at the hardware store. You see strangers in a doctor's waiting room. You see strangers at the exercise club. You see strangers at church, at Rotary, and it goes on and on and on, everywhere. And generally, we have tendency to just sort of avoid or not even make eye contact, not even acknowledge those individuals. But for the purpose of overcoming cold calling fear, we have to now engage. Now, let's talk about how do we do this. Peter, why don't you launch with that?
Well, here's an example. Making an observation about something in the room, like in a grocery cart, and then stating your observation, and then asking a question like, oh, those strawberries in your cart look so good. Is there a special occasion coming up? Doctor's office, you could say, are you waiting for Dr. Smith, let's say, or I hope he's on time today. Or if you're part of the Rotarian, a special club or something, what's the topic for today's lunch? And so if you practice that, you'll get better and better at it. And it doesn't matter if you are, shy or anything. It doesn't matter. If you press through and ask some people, people are really open to engage in conversation.
Yes. And The key is you have to identify something that's commonly known, that's safe, not very, very personal. And so if you notice those strawberries, they better be right there on the top, not buried three layers down.
Right.
And it would not be appropriate in a grocery line to start asking about the child that's sitting in the cart screaming. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a little too personal. You have two individuals that you can engage with, the person in front of you and the person behind you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you blunder through this, if you say the wrong thing, that's fine. You're not, nobody's going to beat you up. Nobody's going to charge you a fee. This is practice. And back to riding the bicycle. The first couple times you got on the bike, you fell off. Well, we have to fall off a few times. The point is, we want you to fall off practicing, not when you're doing your job hunting.
Correct.
So the key muscle that we're starting to alert here and start to exercise is finding a way to engage in conversation. And it's a fear. It's not the topic. It's not what are you going to talk about. It's the fear. And we have to get over that. This is a $100,000 skill that each of us need to master, and we need to do it because our income is that important.
Right.
And so you're sitting in the doctor's office, and you're looking around. Everybody's looking at their smartphone, or if they're older, they're picking up a magazine, looking at that. Maybe their eyes are looking up to the ceiling. Everybody's quiet. Nobody's saying anything. You're going to break the ice, and you're going to turn the person to your left or the right and say, are you seeing Dr. Smith? I sure hope he's on time today. And that's just a harmless little comment. Maybe they'll chuckle about it. No, I'm seeing Dr. Jones. Oh, have you been coming here long? So the second part of this is how to start the conversation, but then after that, you need to keep it going. So you have to have two more follow-up questions that you've rehearsed, you've thought through, they're ready to go, and when the person responds to you, maybe it's just going to be a short little something, and then you smile and you say, oh, and you respond to what they said and you ask another question, and pretty soon they will pick up the rhythm and start talking, and they will start contributing to the conversation because this is fun. Oh, we're talking, and we're both waiting, and why not talk instead of sticking our nose in the magazine or just looking at the smartphone? And that's the whole point. Now, once you become comfortable with doing this, and it does take practice, you have to think ahead of time what you're going to say. You've now overcome the biggest barrier to cold calling. Now, let's go to the third and final practice step, Peter, on how to succeed at cold calling before we actually get into the technique of it. So what's the third step there?
Well, I think we need to look at asking friends for help with contacts in organizations that you want to pursue. So what we've always recommended is have at least 30 organizations, make a list, and meet with the person that your friend knows to ask who's the manager, who oversees the position that you're looking for, because that's, you want the person that has the hiring authority for that position.
It's time for a break, Peter, and after
okay.
the break, hopefully we can start picking up on some of our questions.
All right.
We're taking a short 2-minute break to ask John Bradley some questions about pursuing a post-retirement career to give back, to give meaning and purpose. John, in our last break, you suggested that the idea of a career being something bigger than a paycheck is a worthy thought for a boomer, but also for a 30-something career seeker.
That's right, Evan. We can truly choose a post-retirement career as well as an occupation which provides sufficient income, stability, vacation perks, and still make a difference. And that's because our team has a working knowledge of over 90,000 careers, and many of those fit that description.
Well, John, why wouldn't everyone want meaning and purpose?
Well, unfortunately, many of us have not considered that final layer of preference for our retirement or our present work. We kind of get caught up in the trap of staying employed and reading all the How to Succeed, Move Up the Ladder books and blogs. Many of those helps are valid, but they may not be the best for everyone.
Well, John, for the next break, could you give us some examples of the difference between grinding out a job and finding a career which provides meaning and purpose, even for someone like a boomer?
Sure, let's do it.
Thanks, John. If you just turned in, our Job Seeker weekly broadcast is sponsored by the IDEC Group, hosted by job search and career advancement expert John Bradley. John has been coaching men and women since the mid-70s to find fulfilling work. I'm Evan Newman. You can join our discussion today by emailing us your job search questions. Those questions received during the live broadcast will be given John's priority for discussion. Our address for questions is jobseeker@idacgroup.com. That's jobseeker@idacgroup.com. John, let's return to our broadcast.
And we're back talking about how to succeed at cold calling, and my guest co-host is counselor Peter DePauli. Peter is located in Sherwood, Oregon. He's one of our 12 preferred counselors featured on our website. And if you just tuned in, you can see Peter's picture and bio. Just go to the top of our website, idacgroup.com. Peter, we just dealt with this subject on how to succeed at cold calling. Any closing comments before we turn to our job seeker questions?
Well, John, I think, like we just had mentioned about making sure that you've got a list of people that you are going to ask for help as far as contacts and organizations, and I think that's so important because of the networking. I had one job, my first job, that I ever did on a public job vacancy. I was one of 25 when I got hired at the university when I first started out back in 1980. But every other job since then has always been networking and pursuing it instead of being more on a reactive. I've been more proactive.
Well, and certainly, we can test this theory. Ask five people how they got their last job, and four of them will tell you, I knew someone, or someone
right.
told me. And so that's the point. We want you to spend 80% of your effort in job hunting contacting individuals who know somebody. And everyone has at least 10 family members, friends, neighbors, former colleagues. And you go to those individuals one-on-one. You show them the list of the companies, the nonprofits, that you want to pursue, and you ask them, do you have names of anyone that work in these companies? And then they tell you that name, and you contact that person, you meet with that person, and you say, I'm looking for the name of the department head that heads up this work group. Do you know who that person is, and can I use your name as a referral source? And that is it. And then you begin a relationship with that individual that then will reveal to you the hidden job. That is the whole process. And the actual technique and so on to do that, we will discuss at a later broadcast, but that is it. Overcoming the fear is key. Peter, let's turn to some job seeker questions that have come in. Why don't you take a stab at it?
All right. Well, John, there's one, Anne in Canada, and this is what she says. I'm looking at starting my career and wondered if college was a good investment to get a good paying job. Can you help?
Wow. Well,
I was going to say, John, the statistics are that, you know, you look at high school diploma, bachelor's degree, master's degree, and there is an elevated, you know, source of income better as you go along. The big key for me is, because I teach in college universities for years, is making sure that you know the curriculum or the coursework that you're supposed to be taking based on how you're gifted, and not get in there and say, oh, I have to change my coursework in the middle of it and add another year on, and you're talking $20,000, $30,000 on for a whole another year put on top of it.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Well, even back to the beginning, the question, is it necessary to have a college degree to get a good paying job? No, it is not.
Right.
However, there are some career fields that do require degrees, such as engineering, teaching, nursing, programming, IT, and early childhood education. Those majors are job vocational majors. All the other degrees, Spanish, history, journalism, business, they're teaching courses, but they're not necessarily directly involved in the job. There's one other that I neglected to mention, that was accounting.
Mm-hmm.
So the key here is you've got to find the person that has the job you want and have that person tell you what is needed as far as education to get that job. And now your college education is focused. And a lot of times the major doesn't matter. What matters is the grade point and where you went to school and did you graduate. We've said this time and time again, while you're a student, you want to get a field experience or an internship in exactly the job you want. So in a nutshell, to Ann, it is not necessary to have a college degree to get a good job. What's more important is that you find the person that has a job you want, have that person advise you, have them advise you what school, if it's necessary, and how to get the experience you need to get hired. Peter, let's go to another.
I was going to say absolutely yes. You have got to get that internal validity of saying that's what I really want to do based on I've talked to people out there. I know, and when the storms come of whatever it takes to get that, I'm going to stay the course.
How about another job seeker question?
Yeah, we have Cynthia in Portland. I'm a registered nurse working full-time, and I hate my job. I work night shifts, and I feel like I'm just hanging on. Should I go back to college? Here's another college one. To get a four-year degree in nursing or change careers?
Well, I guess, I don't know, Peter. The thing I'm wondering about is whether Cynthia hates working nights or if she hates the current employer where she's working, the working conditions are poor, or if she actually hates the doing of nursing. There's one thing about nursing, and that is when you're going to school, you get to practice. You're doing it while you're going to school. And
right.
So I would be surprised if Cynthia didn't like the activity of nursing, probably dislikes the working hours and the current job. So step one, I would say, let's find a new employer that gives you better hours. That would be my first option, and you need to broaden out. You've got nurses in retirement homes. You have nurses that work for large companies, particularly if there are there's repeated accidents and injuries on the job, not just hospitals and not just medical clinics. There are even nurses that work in disaster relief organizations. There are nurses that work for inner-city nonprofits. And it goes on and on. So you want to broaden your horizon and look for other options. There even are nurses that work for youth camping organizations and youth outreach organizations. So lots of possibilities there. Peter, any other suggestions to Cynthia?
Well, it's interesting, John. I just was working with a nurse, and he was so burnt out. In fact, he had some heart issues. And basically, it was the stress of the work hours, just like you said. And I worked with him about negotiating going back to the administration because he was serious about making a change. And they fell all over themselves, getting him a better schedule and a better time, the whole thing, because they wanted to keep them. So it wasn't so much the job. It was more the absolute stress and the hours
right. And
the time. That's exactly what it was.
Yes, yes. And really, you know, we talked earlier about cold calling. The best source to get contacts is to go back to your original professors and instructors and have them give you names of individuals that have gone through that training and graduated and are out working in the workforce. That is probably the most productive area. And then, of course, in addition to that, of colleagues, men and women who are nursing and in the workforce, and you're asking them, what's the name of the department head, and could I use your name to contact the individual and begin a discussion? So we're saying to Cynthia, hold on, let's not jump the ship. Let's consider some possibilities in a better work environment before you just quit and go back to school and change careers.
Mm-hmm.
Any other job seeker questions, Peter?
Well, we've got one from Ron in West Lynn. It says, my company is downsizing, and I may lose my job. I do shipping and receiving for a restaurant equipment company. I'm getting married for the first time at 41. Should I look at a new career?
Huh.
Boy, talk about a lot of things at one time.
Yeah, wow.
First of all, do the premarital. Anyway.
Yes. Okay, well, yeah, we have a double stress issue going on. We're getting married, and that is huge, especially at the age of 41. So some major, major changes going on. And then in addition to that, we got the stress that I may lose my job, so I'm losing all my security and so on. You know, I think just on the emotional level, Peter, you're the counselor. You're the expert in this, but you want to reduce as much stress as possible in different chapters of your life. And I would say when you start a new job somewhere else or even go through a job hunt process, that's stressful. You don't want to be doing that in your first year of marriage. So,
right.
Peter, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was just thinking about there's a Holmes-Rae stress inventory, and if you add up a number of stressors for the year and you have a score of over 300, you have a pretty good shot at having some kind of physical malady to happen to you. So, yes, he should look at, you know, not doing too many things at once. The what if of I may lose my job, I mean, again, we're talking the fear factor, getting married, settling down, staying through with it. It's always easier to look for a job when you have a job.
Yes.
So,
actually, if Ron really wanted to do this first cabin, what Ron probably should do is enroll in a two-unit class at a community college. The class would be teaching in the new field that Ron would like to consider. And then while Ron is still employed at his current job, he is doing a field experience in a company that would have a new position. Now, there isn't that much stress in doing a field experience at a new organization because your job's not on the line. You're not worried about your paycheck. We'll pick this up after the break with some more job seeker questions.
We're taking a short 2-minute break at the final quarter of our show to ask John Bradley how one can choose to find meaning and purpose in a post-retirement career as well as a new 30-something job. John, you started this discussion saying that boomers are now free to choose to pursue something fulfilling to give back.
That's right, Evan.
And then I ask, why can't a 30-something person make that choice? And you said they could. They just had to be intentional to add that third layer of purpose rather than just the paycheck. So here's my question. Can you give us an example of someone who has done this?
Well, Evan, I recall a client who worked for the same employer for 35 years as a director of quality control and manufacturing. there was a change in management and our client was transitioned out. As he and I began to discuss his next chapter in life, I challenged him to think about pursuing something that felt like he was making a difference, something meaningful to him.
So this was a real person?
Yes, it was a real person. Let's call him Phil. He had 1 year of community college and felt like his life wouldn't really amount to much. All he thought he could do was find a similar job and then after a few more years retire, buy a big motorhome, and drive coast to coast.
I've seen a few of those.
Well, as we began to explore Phil's aptitude assessment results, he pointed to a couple of the printout options and said, "You know, I always wanted to do something for troubled kids, for teenagers."
So what happened?
A long story short, he got hired by a county government agency to administrate the placement of foster teens in good homes.
Did he have some prior experience to get that?
Not at all. We helped him plan a strategy after he met the person who had his job.
You mean he first looked at several careers you suggested, then chose this one because of the on-site validation visit?
That's right. And in his job search, he bypassed many who had four-year college degrees and even graduate school degrees. And you know, Phil had only 1 year of community college with no prior experience.
Well, I think I'm speaking for our listening audience when I say that this is a great example, and I wish we had time to find out how you helped him do it.
Yes, that's true, Evan, but then that is what these job seeker broadcasts are all about. I am sharing the same things I taught Phil, all these lessons learned, and he did it, and it worked for him.
John, this has been a most interesting journey.
Well, thanks, Evan.
I want to encourage any of you who are feeling the stress of a dead-end job to go to our website, www.IDAC Preferred Counselors. Just tuned in.
We're receiving some technical difficulties in our short two-minute break. Peter, let's move ahead to the questions that have been sent in to us and see if we can grab a few more before our time is up. Have you got another question?
Yes, John. I got one here, Jason in Oregon. I've been in medical sales for over 10 years. The pay is good, but I'm feeling burned out. I like new ventures, and I'm considering having my own business. How do I go about considering starting my own business?
Okay, so, and this type of question we do get a fair amount is, instead of going through the hassle of job hunting, how about starting my own business? As a matter of fact, we devoted a whole broadcast just to this. Mm-hmm. So let's just pick this apart one piece at a time. Jason's got 10 years of sales experience. This is very good. Not because he's in medical sales, but because he's in sales. So he understands what it's like to sell. If you're going to start your own business, this is a huge part of the success factor in getting a business going. Now, when Jason says the pay is good, I'm assuming, hopefully, that he has been storing up some of that pay, and it's earning interest somewhere in a mutual fund or CD and so on. And he says he likes new ventures. Okay, that's very good. We want to make sure that Jason possibly is looking at a business where maybe it's a franchise or maybe someone else he knows has done something similar. Would not be a good idea for Jason to just out of the blue invent something and go do it. So we want Jason to find the person who has done this before for the exact same thing and interview that person for information. What's it like? How does it work? What does it take to do this? Having the sales experience and knowing what that's all about is one major leg on the three-leg stool. Another is you've got to have the money. And so Jason needs to Be sure he has all his expenses covered for equipment, facilities, locations, supplies, and not count on having his income paid for through this enterprise for at least 3 years. So don't count on the income as money in your pocket in lieu of getting a paycheck. The money that comes in is going to pay for your overhead and your expenses. The other thing you have to be careful about, of course, is your enterprise going to hire or require you hiring individuals? So that's important. A good business plan is essential for going into your own business. So that is there. And then the last piece I would say on this is each state has an association of entrepreneurs and startup business people, and I would get active with that organization, take their training courses. There are such things as angel investors, people that are willing to talk to you about your idea and maybe consider helping you finance. But the best source of money is going to be family and friends. Peter, any other thoughts for Jason?
Well, John, I teach a coaching and mentoring class in the university, and I think the mentor is so important. I mean, somebody that's been there, done that, and that whole mentoring process is I do, you watch, then we both do together, then you do, I watch, and then you go find somebody to do it with. So he really needs to be coached. I know the Small Business Administration a lot of times has some people that are willing, that they've been, you know, they're retired now, but they're available for mentoring and stuff.
Yes.
And I think that would be really, really key.
Yeah, and then the name of that group is, the SBA has that, but there's another group called SCORE, S-C-O-R-E. I don't exactly remember what each of those letters stand for, but that is the name of the organization, and it's usually retired men and women that are professionals, and they give their time free to someone who needs coaching. Well, I think we've helped Jason. Any other job seeker questions, Peter?
Well, this is a unique one, and maybe we got some time for this. David in Washington, my daughter works for our family business, but she's not happy here. How can I encourage her to start looking for a job elsewhere? She seems to be reluctant to take a risk in something new, as she has been working for our company since her youth.
Okay. Well, surprisingly, you and I get a lot of sons and daughter referral because we've helped mom or dad.
Right.
And certainly in family businesses, it's typical that the son and daughter, even the son-in-law and daughter-in-law, are recruited because they're trustworthy. Everyone knows everyone. And that's the whole nucleus of a family business. But the daughter's not happy. And it seems, Peter, that the fear of breaking out on her own is stronger than not being happy. The pain of not being happy is not as strong as the pain of making a change. How would you mentor, coach the daughter to start taking some small steps to get out there and look around?
Well, she's got a good track record with the family business, but maybe somebody that has interacted with the family business would take her under their wings and show her the ropes on another occupation. She should maybe get an assessment and see where her strengths are. And again, go back to that internship practicum. She's going to school. Try it out. Try it for a week, try it for a month, try it for a semester, so that she sees that there's other things that she can do other than the family business.
Yeah, and really, you know, as I'm thinking about it, she could become a victim here by saying, well, who's going to hire me? I don't want to do the job I'm doing. What else can I do? Because every time I look at a job vacancy, they want to know what experience I have. Well, the experience I have is a job that I hate. I don't want to do this job.
Right.
How do I break out of this? Well, the simple way to break out of this, as you said, Peter, is to take an assessment, find out some new options. But let's take a course or two and do it within this new field because you're now going to meet some people. The professor's going to have contacts.
Right.
And so now through the professor, you have access to all those that have graduated years and years down the road, as well as individuals that the professor knows. And all of a sudden, we're getting a rhythm going of not only brushing elbows with people in this new career direction, but also getting contacts, names of individuals. And it sounds like dad wants to support daughter, so her job's not at risk. This is a perfect situation for daughter to write her own ticket and really take off. It's ideal.
Yeah, and it's a good time because it would be a win-win because you don't want to leave the family business with a bitter taste in your mouth.
Yes. I've even seen situations in family businesses where I coach the parents to allow the son or daughter to do a different job that they were suited for, different than their present job, so they could get the work experience so that they could then put that on their resume when they were actively looking out there for that new role. So that's another possibility, if the business can afford that. Sometimes you can't afford to pay somebody for something you really don't need done just for that person's career advancement. But,
right.
that would be another option, I think.
Right. And like we've always talked about, John, 90% of businesses tend to be under 20 employees. Well, a lot of those are family businesses. So why not it be an incubation place for somebody to launch for a new career and be a blessing both sides, you know?
Absolutely, yes. Any more job seeker questions, Peter?
Well, we've got Jonathan in San Diego, and he's a professional in a jet propulsion lab as a physicist. He's also started up and sold his own business. I like turnaround type of work. How do I find turnaround types of job opportunities?
Well, certainly a turnaround job opportunity, once you've turned it around, is now you're part of the status quo. You're part of the establishment. So my assumption would be Jonathan would prefer turnaround jobs indefinitely. And as soon as things were turned around, he wanted to move on. Well, there is a profession called turnaround consultants. There are people that do this professionally. It's a pretty tough kind of consulting. It generally is for companies. By the time a company calls in a turnaround professional, they're down to the last count. They normally don't call somebody in the first time they lost their credit line or somebody walked out that was key to the company's survival. Usually the owner and all the key peoples try to keep it going, and then when they finally run out of all their options, a turnaround person comes in with nothing left to do. No assets. There are people that do this full time. One of the things that Ron also could explore is venture capital companies loan money to new startups. And let's say 30% of those startups fail. Well, there you've got a built-in situation where you're jumping in to rescue a venture capital-funded operation to turn it around. You also have franchise national offices where the franchise owner is starting to go under, and the national or the state office sends a representative to help turn this thing around. You also have professional associations. These are like professional clubs where the members are business owners, and you belong to that association, and you are like an inside consultant. You can go and assist the members. They invite you to come in you do your assessment, and then you lay out the procedure that you would take to turn this around. So I think options are all options. Peter, we've run out of time. I want to say thank you to the listeners. This is the Job Seeker broadcast, and my guest host today was Peter DePauli. Thank you, and look forward to listening, to have you listening to our show next time. Bye-bye for now.